Herbert Joe Burton, conducted by Robin Gollan, on the 7th of October 1982.
One of the reasons that I came to Canberra was that Copeland was Vice Chancellor. I had read the National University Act. I saw that they contemplated a possible incorporation of the college into the university at an appropriate stage. I knew it couldn't be for at least 10 years.
You came in 1948.
I was appointed in 48, about November, if I remember rightly, and I was under a legal obligation to give 6 months' notice of leave, and anyhow, I didn't want to leave the University of Melbourne in a hole, because I was head of the Economic History Department and I had a job to do. So I continued teaching through 1949 and flying up to Canberra whenever necessary for meetings of council, meetings of committees, appointment committees, finance committee and all that kind of thing. And I realised that Canberra University College at that stage, with a few hundred students nearly all part-time, that it was going to be a long time before we would be in a position to expect to become part of the National University. But I, from the beginning, I thought that was a logical and sensible development, as well as being a thing that was foreshadowed by the founders of the ANU, and I steadily remained in favour of it, although there were some people in the college, as you know, who would have preferred to become the University of Canberra. But I think Menzies was hard-headed enough to see that at that stage two universities in Canberra would be rather a lot to expect.
Yeah. Do you think a majority of the members of the college staff were against amalgamation?
I don't think a majority were. We never had a... I think if you went back to the discussions on the board of the Board of Studies of the college, you'd find that the majority opinion was in favour of the amalgamation of the two institutions. And I certainly remained firmly of that opinion. Although at times, if the decision was to have a separate university, well, I would have had to accept the fact.
I recall, of course, the opposition within the Institute to amalgamation.
Yes.
And I'm biased in this matter because I was one of the minority who was always in favour of it.
Yes.
In fact, I remember one meeting, and I can't remember the exact date, but it's a few years before the shotgun wedding.
Yes.
It was a combined faculties of the Research School of Social Sciences and Pacific Studies.
Yes.
And if I remember rightly, there were only three of us who favoured
Really, as sure as that, yeah.
Finally, of course, when the decision was made by the government, there was a big turnaround.
Yes.
The majority then favoured amalgamation.
Yes.
The opposition in the first instance, I think, can be put down very largely to the idea that amalgamation would reduce some of the enormous privileges of people.
Yes.
On the old ANU, later the Institute staff.
Yes. Yeah.
One can recall people saying, you know, our library privileges, for example, will be watered down when we've got to allow students to use the library and things like this.
Yes.
My own attitude towards it was that it would be good for
the
postgraduate school to be associated in an institution which also had undergraduates. And I'm convinced still that that is the case.
Yes.
even though I feel the amalgamation didn't greatly affect the Institute. It didn't really bring most of the staff into contact with undergraduates.
No, it did not.
It's a very important part of university life, it seems to me. However, yes, you know, it was pointed out to me by, I remember Alec Hope saying to me, that you were extremely unselfish in regard to this matter, because if the University of Canberra had been set up, you'd have been the Vice-Chancellor. you put the public interest before your own private interests.
Yes, well, I had no great aspirations to be a Vice-Chancellor. To be the principal of a college was quite exacting enough without having it further expanded.
I noticed that, well, the instruction to bring about amalgamation was contained in a letter from Prime Minister Menzies.
Yes.
I think on the 19th of December. Then there's a council meeting early in January.
Yes.
At which the general framework, or was it an initial discussion of the general framework of the amalgamation, then a further meeting in February where a lot of decisions were made about how the thing was going to operate.
Yes.
I was thinking that must have been a pretty hectic Christmas for people such as you.
Well, we probably didn't meet till late in January, so that we would have had a fairly normal Christmas break, because practically everyone was back by the end of January, beginning of February, to get on with their jobs. I had the feeling at the time that the strongest opposition came from some of the heads of the medical and the research school of medical science and the research school of physics. Borry, I think, was always a good supporter of the idea of,
I think he was,
coming together, and he used to come and do some teaching in the college long before the amalgamation took place. But I was never very sure of the attitude of other people in the Research School of Social Sciences or the Research School of Pacific Studies. Some of them were more favourable naturally than others. But I always thought that their positions would be safeguarded by their terms of appointment, which were quite clear and definite.
That's right. one of the criticisms, of course, that was made, and most notably by Oliphant, was that the quality of the staff at the school wasn't good enough to be.
Yes, I have somewhere a copy of the section in this biography of Oliphant, where he speaks or wrote directly on this point, and where he was completely uninformed and ignorant of the facts. And that came out very clearly when you looked at the people that we had in our senior positions. After all, his statement that most of the members of the college teaching staff, academic staff, would not have been appointed as fellows in the Institute. Well, some of them transferred, so that's right.
Yeah. Well,
and there was a movement both ways.
Yes. Well, just to mention a few of the people who were here then, there was Manning Clark, Alec Hope,
right.
Bing Crisp, Hindsound, Bielenstein,
yes.
Scales,
right.
Top man in his field. Well, you don't need to go any further than Grace Eddy University, of course.
Quite. And the Professor of Law, John Fleming, in those days, was.
He went to a chair in the
University of California.
Yeah. Yes, they're a very, very remarkable group, really.
Yes. And a lot of the people who didn't have chairs were nevertheless the material to occupy chairs later.
Yeah. Who was the professor of philosophy? Kurt Beyer.
Kurt Beyer went off to America. Yes, he was a professor of philosophy at that stage before the nomination.
And also a very, very eminent man.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, I think we can dismiss that proposition. Any fair-minded person would.
Well, I think we were particularly fortunate in the calibre of the staff that we were able to recruit during the 50s, and then when we established the Faculty of Science, that decision was taken in 59, I think, and we actually, I think, had appointed all the professors in the science departments before we before the amalgamation took place. Well, they were a good bunch. Also, Desmond Smith in biology was quite outstanding. In fact, they were all, I think, very good appointments. Yeah. Hambley in chemistry, Dunbar in physics. Geology, David Brown. We had no reason to be ashamed of any of them.
Just a couple of particular things, Joe. I don't know whether you recall this, but in the amalgamation, in the Act, the Institute was left in control of doctoral degrees.
Yes.
And the School of Master's Degrees.
Yes.
If I remember rightly.
Yes, I think that was so.
Yeah, I've got a note on it here from the Council Minutes. Now, the school opposed the inclusion of this in the Act and would have preferred to leave it as something on which the University Council could make any regulations or statutes or whatever.
Yes.
Now, I wonder why that wasn't done.
I'm afraid I can't help you much on that, Bob, but I suppose the fact that the ANU, through the various various schools, research schools, had the monopoly, you might say, of doctoral work at that stage, but doesn't seem any very good reason why that should have continued after that it should have been reserved for them after amalgamation, because they would go on bringing out their PhD students just the same, even if people from the various faculties in the School of General Studies were also doing the same thing.
Yeah. Now, this was later changed, wasn't it? That would be after your time as principal, I think.
Yes, I can't recall when that took place.
I think it took place when Sir John Crawford became Vice-Chancellor.
Yes.
And as far as I can see from the bare bones of Council Minutes and so on, that he really brought about a major reorganisation of the administration.
Yes.
Directed towards a more effective university-wide administration.
Yes, yes.
My impression, and here your opinion would be very valuable, my impression is that in the first years and during the whole of your principalship,
yes,
they really functioned as two separate sets of administration.
Yes. I think that's roughly correct. What stage did Melville retire?
He retired at the time of of amalgamation.
Yes, and then Huxley succeeded.
Yeah.
Well, if you'd like to switch that off for a moment, Bob, would you like to go back over some?
Yes. one of the proposals that was put forward by the school very early in the piece was that the principal of the school should be ex officio deputy vice chancellor.
Yes.
I wondered, and this was turned down by council.
Yes. I must say I never had any aspirations to occupy that job. I knew that it wouldn't be acceptable, or that was not likely to be acceptable to many of the heads of the research schools, if any, in the Institute of Advanced Studies. And frankly, I had quite enough responsibility. And moreover, if my memory is right, Trendle occupied the position of deputy vice chancellor.
Yeah. And well, that came later, actually.
What stage, do you remember what stage it came?
I've got it right over here somewhere. I'll just turn that off for a minute.
Yes, I had a feeling that at the time that Trendle was occupying the position of deputy vice chancellor. I knew what an able person Trendle was, and incidentally, the college had a great deal of help from him in the period from the very beginning when he took up his position as master of University House. He was sympathetic and extraordinarily helpful as far as the college was concerned. We regularly had him on committees for appointments, and I thought it would be ridiculous to try to displace him or to be in competition with him for the position of deputy vice chancellor.
I can understand someone not having an ambition to take on that job. Very easy.
Yes.
Or vice chancellor for that matter.
Yes.
Dreadful job, I think. Yeah. Now, there's one very ironical one here, Joe, that you mightn't want to talk about, but it's particularly ironical in terms of what's happened to Burton Hall.
Yes.
There was a proposal that the first college should be named Burton Hall.
Yes.
You're aware of that?
I'm not sure that I was aware of that. I can't recall. I certainly never had any expectation that the first college would be named after me. And in the light of events, I'm a little bit sorry I agreed to the later one.
Oh dear. Well, if the first proposal had gone through, of course, this wouldn't have happened.
Well, the situation would have been different.
Yeah.
That's quite true.
Yeah. Yes, the board of the school recommended that, that the first Hall of Residence be Burton Hall.
Yeah,
but that's obviously water under the bridge.
Well, I think you'll realise from my forgetfulness on the matter that though I would have appreciated the honour, I didn't think it was warranted, and I suffered no bitter disappointment when it was named after the Chancellor of the University. Incidentally, when did Lord Bruce step down from... We had Cockcroft for a time, didn't we?
Yeah.
Or should I call him Cockcroft?
I don't know. I haven't pronounced his name.
I've heard it both ways.
I've got it here somewhere. Registrar of the SGS, May 1962.
What was that one, Bob?
Colin Plowman.
Colin Plowman, yes.
In May 62.
That's right. And Tom Owen went to be assistant registrar to Ross Herman.
That's right.
Yes.
In charge of
yes.
property and plan.
Yes.
So on, yes.
Yes, Colin Plowman and I worked very happily together for my last few years of principal of the School of General Studies, and we had some tough problems to deal with, and we were able to do it by patience and the exercise of a little wisdom and restraint.
Yeah. Do you mean by difficult problems, problems in relation to the students, or...?
No, I'm thinking particularly in relation to one or two staff problems.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Now, I realise who one of them was, at least.
Yes.
Yes. I did want to ask you something about that, without asking you to give away any secrets, but...
Mm.
Now, I can't quite find when Cocroft, I've got it noted here somewhere,
yes,
became Chancellor.
Yes.
He, of course, was followed by Florey.
Yes.
And Florey was followed by Maggot Coombs, I think.
I think that's right.
Chancellor, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Anyhow, that's something that could easily be established from the... from the official records.
Oh, yes, it's in the calendars.
There's no point in even going back to it at this particular moment.
I've got a note on it here.
Yes.
Now, there are various... Well, first of all, just asking your recollections of any about problems of study leave. Now, it's quite clear that the... staff in the school had much inferior conditions of study leave as compared with the staff in
the
institute.
However, that was a matter of history, and my recollection was that the staff of the School of General Studies had at least as good conditions of study leave and salary as the Australian universities in general. And they saw no particular reason why, as a result of an amalgamation, this situation should change, and it would have been bitterly resented in the other universities, I think, throughout Australia, if it had changed in any way to the advantage of our people, and it would have given us a very great edge in competition for recruiting staff, but I don't think we needed an edge. We were filling our positions very happily and successfully on the conditions that we had.
Well, they did improve later. What I was thinking of particularly was the study leave grants,
yes,
which for the school were very much inferior to
yes,
the institute.
Yes.
And indeed they still are, but only marginally so now.
Yeah. Yeah. But I imagine that this would be a system fairly general throughout the Australian universities, wouldn't it?
Yes. yes.
Bob, and that our people wouldn't expect any edge over there. Their colleagues in other universities.
No, there simply was a general improvement in all Australian universities, and
yes,
I presume the school followed that rather than anything else.
Mm. Of course, we had a little bit of an edge in some ways in having a certain number of national undergraduate scholarships.
Yes.
And I think it's a matter of regret that this number hasn't been expanded. There's some figures that the Vice-Chancellor had published within the last week or so shows that we are not attracting as many people from outside Canberra at present as we were 10 years ago.
Mm.
Nothing, not nearly as many.
I haven't seen that.
And for a national university, I think it would be warranted to have some increase in the number of national undergraduate scholarships that we can offer.
Sure.
After all, this is a university supported by the national government of the country.
Yeah.
It should be open to the ablest people throughout Australia. Well, it is open to them,
yeah,
but some help and some incentives to come here wouldn't be out of place.
No, well, we have obviously got a number of very, very able students through,
yes,
the national scholarships.
Yes, we have indeed.
And in many cases they've come here because they reckon it's the best place to do the particular study that they,
yes,
want to do.
Yes, and I think the scholarships for Asian studies in particular were very well warranted.
Yeah.
The country is not big enough to support first-rate schools of Asian studies in every university in Australia, so it makes some common sense to aim at having one particularly good centre, and hope that others would have very good centres also.
Mm. Yes, I think it's a shame that this hasn't been expanded.
Yes.
Of course, for the last 6 or 7 years, nothing's been expanded, of course.
Quite.
Quite to the contrary.
Yes.
Yeah. There are a couple of important developments in your period after amalgamation. One was the forestry story.
Yes.
Which I gather was a fairly protracted and at times acrimonious battle.
Yes.
Have you got any recollections of this?
I can't recall the details of this, and this is where it would be useful perhaps to bring in Tom Owen at some stage.
Yeah.
But I do remember my own feeling for about this was that it would be a sensible and very practical thing, seeing that the forestry school was already established here and called the Australian Forestry School, to bring it within the university at the appropriate time. And the appropriate time seemed to me to be when we were developing the science faculty as a whole. And that is roughly when the decision was taken, was it not?
The firm decision to set up a Department of Forestry and incorporate the school,
yes,
was made in March 1963.
It was
under discussion,
yeah,
for a very long time,
yes,
before that.
Yes.
Yeah. And it actually became operative, I think,
yes,
from the,
that's
beginning,
right,
of the
in
year
my
of
last
64.
Couple of years,
yeah,
with
it was physically still
Eric Ovington as the first professor of,
yeah,
of forestry.
Yeah. He was the first professor, was he?
I believe so,
yes, yes,
if my memory is right.
Mm. He's got a government job now, of course.
Yes.
Mm. it hadn't physically moved from Yarralumla in
no
time, I guess.
Mm. Yes. Mm. Yes, it had to wait on the new buildings. In fact, those buildings along that side of the university, the science buildings from physics down to biology and botany and forestry, had to wait for the funds to come after amalgamation, really.
Yeah.
The early science departments were housed in the old temporary huts that the administration vacated.
We're up near the Coombs building.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. The other one that I'm sure you took an interest in, well, you took an interest in everything, of course, but were the series of proposals and committees and reports and so on teacher education.
Yes. I think I have given my file, my personal file on teacher education, to Tom Owen. uh-huh. for the archives just a few months ago. My feeling was not that we should necessarily have a Department of Education or a Faculty of Education, but that we should see that some provision was made in Canberra for the education of teachers. Mm. I had greatest difficulty in persuading Professor Huxley, the Vice Chancellor, that this was desirable. In fact, in my last year, one of my memos to the Vice Chancellor was, I thought it was imperative that we should have a policy on teacher education, that it wasn't reasonable to expect that the state of New South Wales should have to pay for the training of and education of teachers to work in the territory, and we ought to make our contribution. But I didn't get anywhere on it at that stage. And of course, when the College of Advanced Education came, the matter of teacher education was handled there.
I've got a note here that says, this must have been in response to your urgent request that a decision be made at the council meeting in July 65.
Yes.
The council decided that there would be a decision on it the next council meeting.
Yes.
Which I can't find any record of.
I think you're right. I don't think any decision was made. But here again, Tom Owen will probably be able to help us confirm or that or otherwise.
Yeah. Well, it might be an idea if you can manage it, if we have another session with Tom here too.
I think that would be very useful, Bob. If I hadn't been feeling so flat this morning, I was going to ring Tom and say that I was coming to see you and I'd drop in to see him afterwards. But after lunch, I've got to go and see my skin specialist.
One thing I noticed, I recalled it when I saw the reference to it in council minutes and letters and so on, was the prescription of Lolita as a prescribed text by the English department. It was in... Do you remember this? Lolita was a banned book.
Yes, yes, I remember.
And Bob Brissenden, I think it was.
Yes.
This was in 1964. Yeah.
Yes.
And I think there was a fuss in Parliament. Somebody denounced the university bringing filth to the attention of young students.
Yes.
And Alec Hope wrote a very strong letter to the Vice Chancellor, replying to the criticism.
Yes.
And the Vice Chancellor replied in what seems to me to be a pretty snooty fashion.
Yes.
Rejecting the argument.
Yes.
Now, I wondered whether you came into that at all.
The year was 1964?
The reference to it in council minutes is in May 64.
May of 1964. Yeah. That had slipped out of my mind, which probably means that I wanted to forget it, doesn't it? Now that you recall it, I do remember this incident, and I can't specifically recall what the... I presume it came before the board of the school.
Must have, yes.
For discussion, and then on to council from there. I myself had, in the 30s, got involved in the Australian Council for Civil Liberties because of my opposition to censorship. I have read Lolita, incidentally. I'm not over-impressed by it, but I didn't see then or now any particular reason for banning it. On the other hand, it might have been unnecessary to prescribe it if the book was available.
Well,
but certainly I would have backed up the professor of English and his department on their freedom to prescribe what books they thought were most suitable for the classes they were giving.
I think the position was that one method of getting banned books or making them available to students was to prescribe them.
Yes. That I believe that's right, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I think this is what...
They could be obtained for purposes of serious study.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
I suppose it would make some difference there whether you prescribed it for honours work or pass.
Well, of course, one of the... In the period that you'd remember in the 30s, one of the stupidities of the censorship was, although one can understand the reason, one of the stupidities was that high quality works
were banned.
High quality production.
Oh, yes.
In other words, expensive books.
Yes, were able to slip through.
That's right.
Yep. Yes.
On the other hand, paperback editions of the same thing were banned.
Yes. Yes. That was a feature of the situation then, I believe. And I think Fan Frolico Press in London with Stevenson and Lindsay were taking advantage of that.
Yeah, I think they were. Yeah. Well, presumably the assumption was that the rich are less corruptible than the poor.
Well, it didn't matter if they were corrupted, they were corrupt already, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, you're not feeling too strong, so I think we might turn out this.
Well, if there's anything else that you would like to
One particular question
get on to while I'm here, I'm not at the point of exhaustion yet.
Right. One particular question in reference to a staff problem.
Yes.
That I wondered whether you'd be prepared to comment on, and I'm referring to the case of Ron Heiser.
Yes.
And I know about that because I remember you and I having a long talk about it.
Yes.
What to be done. What,
yes, how it could be helped if possible.
Yeah.
Mm.
Now, the reason that he was superannuated was alcoholism. There's no doubt about that.
And yes.
The alternatives were that he should be sacked or... I think you were responsible for really getting him superannuation rather than dismissal.
Yes, well, it was the time of the Orr case,
yes.
You recall, in the 50s, wasn't it?
It was 1961, I think.
1960s, early 1960s, yes. Mm. Well, this is a matter that Colin Plowman and I dealt with, I remember. And we had to handle it very delicately because we were fully conscious of the furor around the world in academic circles about this dismissal of Orr in Tasmania, which in itself was something that should never have happened. They should have accepted his resignation when it was handed in, instead of taking the vindictive line of having the pleasure of dismissing him. Well, we were very conscious of the Orr case, and we were also had some sympathy for Heiser, who was an extraordinarily good economist, and if he hadn't had this weakness and had been able to do his undergraduate teaching as his job demanded, well, there wouldn't have been any question of him being dismissed, but he was missing classes, not giving classes when he should have done. And fortunately, he was in receipt of an army pension.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for, I think, psychiatric troubles during the war period, and he was medically boarded out on, I think, what were reasonable... on a reasonable pension. So I was glad that we were able to handle it in that way, both for his own sake and the sake of his family, and for the sake of the university too.
I wondered whether, if at any stage, his political views were raised as an issue.
To my knowledge, not at all. We knew his political views when he was appointed. And I think I can say now that I didn't agree with the majority decision to appoint him in the first place. I thought it was a mistake because I was aware then of his tendency towards alcoholism. And that was the only reason why. It wasn't on any grounds of ability that I opposed his appointment, but you've got to take into account other things as well as capacity. And actually, in his first few years as a lecturer, he did very well, but after that, he lapsed.
Yeah.
And that was the sad fact of the matter.
Oh, yes.
I always thought it was a pity that he hadn't got a research fellowship where this weakness wouldn't have mattered to any great extent. Yeah. Well, not to the same extent.
Quite, because, you know, even after he was superannuated, he still...
Yes. He still had articles published in international journals. Mm-hmm. He was obviously a man of intellectual capacity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I assume that his well-known and vociferous political views hadn't been a factor in the case.
I don't think it was a factor in the case, and certainly not so far as my colleagues were concerned in the School of General Studies.
More generally, Joe, did you ever apprehend any sort of political pressure on appointments or this sort of thing? I remember that, you know, for example, when Hans Arndt was appointed.
Yes, I recall that very well.
It was a public...
Yes.
I think it was McMahon who denounced him.
McMahon, who had been one of his students in Sydney, asked the Prime Minister in the House what he was going to do about this scandalous appointment of a communist to the staff of the Canberra University College. And you remember the Prime Minister, to his everlasting credit, said he wasn't going to do anything. It was a matter for the Canberra University College Council, and he didn't propose to interfere.
So you didn't ever experience? After all, we're talking...
Yes.
Talking about the depths of the Cold War, aren't
we? Yeah. Yes. There's one thing that I think ought to be recorded. Our first two appointments, you may recall, were Professor Crisp to the Chair of Political Science and Manning Clark to the Chair of History. Now, when I brought before the Council of the University College the recommendation of the committee that we offer the Chair of History to Manning Clark, two of the members of the council, I think, said, well, they would want a security check before they would agree to accepting this recommendation. Well, I was rather staggered. After all, I had known Manning Clark as a student through his period in Melbourne. I'd been in constant touch with him. I knew perfectly well he was not a member of the Communist Party, that he was not an adherent to communist doctrine. But he was had a very social democratic attitude, and he certainly wasn't a conservative. Well, I was a bit horrified at this suggestion. However, I was so confident of the recommendation, I said, well, if you want a security check, you can have one. I'm quite confident about what the result will be. And that was that. I think, I can't remember with certainty whether we had another similar case.
You did get a report from ASIO, did you?
Oh yes, oh yes, we got a report from the security people, and it was satisfactory, so there was no hitch about the appointment. There may have been another case as well, but I can't recall. Perhaps I'm mixing it up with Hartwell in the University of New South Wales, when he objected to security checks, didn't he?
Yes, well, that was the specific case of Russell Ward.
Yes.
At
the moment, this is the only specific one. And there was one in the Institute about the man, the anthropologist from Manchester, wasn't there? This comes out in... what's the name of the man who did the typescript on the early history?
Lewis.
Yes, Milton Lewis.
Yes.
That comes out in his narrative.
Well, that was a different case.
Rather a different one, wasn't it?
He was. I was. Remember this because I was on council at the time.
Yes, and it was about his going into New Guinea.
Well, he was a very eminent anthropologist.
Anthropologist, exactly.
Max Gluckman.
Yes.
Professor of Anthropology at Manchester.
Yes.
And he was refused an entry visa, entry permit into New Guinea.
Yes.
And no reasons were stated.
Yeah.
But there were, as always in these cases, there are rumours around.
Yes.
And at least one of the rumours was that it was sexual deviance of some kind. Devil, he was going to practice these deviant habits in a 3-week visit to New Guinea, beyond me.
I assumed it was because of his political attitude. Or
he apparently, well, that seems to be the most likely.
Yes.
He was not a communist, of course.
Hmm.
But he had at one stage been a member of the British Soviet Friendship Society or something of that kind.
Yes.
In which I think his wife was more active than he was.
Hmm.
And that was sufficient, apparently.
Yes.
Yeah.
In particular, and to a certain extent, Enor too, were very snooty about the whole idea of any coming together.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm.
Mm. Where is he now? Have you any idea?
He's in Canberra.
He's in Canberra.
Yeah.
Working in the public service?
Yes.
Working
in social security or some aspect of welfare. Mm.
And he was working at one stage in the Department of History in Newcastle. This is,
I believe he was, yes.
72, this note.
Yes, well, what he did there was to build up that report into an MA thesis.
Mm.
Yeah, you were saying that you thought that there was particular opposition in the 50s in the science school.
Yes,
yeah.
Is that your impression?
Oh, yes.
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 They were hellishly snooty, weren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, intolerable, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I always remained polite and urban.